Today on Ingo Latino.
Think about ways that you might be, if you're a startup working on an innovative question, you might be the solution to a larger organization's innovation problem. Who are the companies out there that this would matter to? And if they are not going to be able to meaningfully tackle this inside their company, how do you get on their radar? How do you work with them to say, I've been looking at issues like A, B, and C. I really think I can, you know, help you think about that problem in a way that you'd have a hard time doing it yourself.
Sanford has been able to implement innovations in the media as well as data to increase engagement and cultural intelligence. He's provided these services to a wide range of organizations, including Viacom, CBS, Simon & Schuster, Univision, MIT, and many others. He's experimented with new ways to tell stories, and he champions a way for organizations to adopt innovation in the long run. He calls it slow innovation. Today in our show, we have an innovative pioneer in the very sense of the word, Sam Ford. This is Ingo Latino.
Hola mi gente, les habla Gonzalo Peña, and welcome to another edition of Ingo Latino podcast. Let me ask you this. Have you ever entered a field that no one or almost no one is getting into and then discovered that you are a pioneer and that you are actually pushing the boundaries of that field? Well, I have one of those authorities in the field of innovation in the media, and it's such a great pleasure to welcome Sam Ford to Ingo Latino. Bienvenido. Welcome, Sam.
Really appreciate it, Gonzalo. I'm happy to be here today. I will check is in the mail for that introduction. I tell people all the time as I'm counseling younger folks, I said, not since I was a bank teller in the summer between my undergraduate days in grad school, have I had a job that existed before I took it.
Wow.
And so that sounds really cool, I think, he says. But on the other hand, it also brings with it all sorts of challenges, right? Each time you're trying to go for what project you might work on next, it is a complicated storytelling endeavor to help people understand how you might solve their problem.
Yeah, I guess that's the price of being a genius, huh?
I'm not responding to that one, but I appreciate the sentiment. It reminds me of, there's a veteran professional wrestler named the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels, and he had a showdown with a younger wrestler, a rookie, and he said to him at one point, "You don't even know enough to know that you don't know."
Whoa.
And that has always stuck with me because I think, as I'm sure you've probably experienced in your own life, the more we get to know of the world, the more we realize how little any one of us not just knows, but can know, right? Like even if we were the maximum version of ourselves, how much can one person No. And I think anytime I meet somebody who, tells me that they're the guru on X, I'll know immediately they must not be. only because if a problem's that easy to master, it might not be one worth tackling.
I absolutely agree. Besides, the attitude of learning is what makes probably the learned learned.
Yeah. absolutely. One of the things I have liked about working with a diverse array of different types of companies, different types of problems, has been the chance to learn a new field or a new division or a new set of questions to tackle with any project that comes along. I spent a few years working in the agency world, and that's one of the things I loved most, is that you had all these different clients and they all have really different businesses. In my case, a lot of our clients were B2B. So it would be manufacturing, agricultural, accounting, cybersecurity, bank, insurance company. And it's just, you know, you'd hop from one call to the next and you'd leave one person's world and reality and regulatory environment and everything else. And then hop on the phone. That sort of variety is interesting and compelling. But yeah, you know, when I come across somebody like I did, I was at Simon & Schuster for a lot of the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And there are people there who have worked at Simon & Schuster in book publishing for decades. And that depth of knowledge really fascinates me because, you know, no one person can do it all. Chosen a career path that has taken me across a wide range of experiences, which means I know a little bit about a lot of things. And one of the things that excites me is when you can find a connection from one industry, one sector, one realm, one problem over here that might apply over there. That's only possible if there are also people you're working with who have such deep sector expertise in the exact problem of the moment. You know, that's why it takes a team in almost any endeavor to solve a problem, because you have to bring complementary expertise to the table.
I absolutely agree. In that sense, that would make you like a connector as well. Am I right?
That's one of the things that I have and the projects that I've worked on. I've tell people often, if you know what you're looking for, it'll never be me. and it's for this very reason. You know, if somebody knows the exact problem they need solved and they need a deep expert to solve that problem, I don't think I would be useful to them. There are far better people. And it is really that here's a question. We don't quite know how to tackle it. What model should we take to approach it? How do we do this differently? Those are the types of questions where I hope the mix of backgrounds, the connector piece of this, I've also think of it sometimes as translating. You started off the podcast bilingually. So I know, you know, that sort of piece of this is to say, here is something that comes from a different sector, a different business than yours. You know, it might be an idea from the startup space that could serve an innovation team at a company really well. It might be an idea from the marketing sector that could help a podcast company, you know, but it is really just that sort of, here's an idea that might port over. That's what I like to bring to the table. And especially when I'm working with people who can then say that will never work here, and here are the 8 reasons why. Again, that's why you need a team on any innovation project.
Makes absolute sense.
My colleague and my second in command at Univision is a gentleman named Federico Rodriguez Tarditi. And Federico is now with a group called Parley for the Oceans, which focuses on innovative corporate partnerships around environmental issues when it comes to plastics and ocean health.
Very well.
And they're doing some really innovative things. But Federico and I did some reflecting in probably the 6 months after we left Univision and wrote a piece for Harvard Business Review on the concept of slow innovation. And our idea behind that is, rather than the sort of rapid deployment and sort of, you know, go big or go home means of thinking, how do you think about tackling the problems that are number 6 on the list of priorities currently? But it's still important, right? Like, hey, this is important, but it's not our main focus. Does that mean you don't do anything on it at all? Or is there a slow track to put it on that has steady progress through test and learn, through trying things, through piloting things? Similarly, you know, we thought a lot about the question of how do you start working on projects that may not be likely to impact business this quarter or even this year, but could become really crucial in the years to come? And do you wait until it becomes crisis before you really start dealing with it? Or are there ways that you start tackling it, piloting it, trying things now? That was really the focus of our lab. We walked into it saying Univision was a pretty innovative company. On top of that, many of these newsrooms that they had acquired were known for hiring a lot of really innovative digital people. when it comes to what I'd call fast innovation or, kind of projects on the fly. It's why we structured our team around, well, when you want to do something, but it's the sort of question you don't quite know where to start, then you come to us. Because 9 times out of 10, if it's something innovative that your team can do and you're already doing it today, you're going to do it. If it's a massive company-wide immediate innovation question that the whole company is trying to work on this year, then that's a corporate-wide mission. There's something in between that, and that's that realm of slow innovation, which here are the sets of questions we think may be important, but they're not the main focus. How do we set aside a little space, a workshop, to start picking away at those questions and thinking about them over time? And that's really what our focus was over the course of the 2 years. In fact, we learned a few lessons, and I'm happy to recap them for you.
Please, because what I'm finding is that this type of approach would help any firm, instead of being reactive, being proactive in future issues that they might encounter. Am I right?
Absolutely. The one thing I'll say, did we learn a lot with Univision? Yes. Is what we did have material impact on them as a business? No. And in part because it only lasted 2 years. So when I say, I would have done it differently if I'd known it was a 2-year endeavor. And of course, nobody knew. There were so many factors that were at play when they started this that weren't there when we finished or had changed dramatically. But I do feel like if you, these are great when you're thinking about a long-term plan. And they're great because if you spend half as much but commit to doing it for twice as long, it's not going to be a major cost center inside your company. You think about, we don't want to be caught flat-footed on these issues. Let's invest a little bit now. Let's pilot some things. Let's build. Let's test and learn. So, the things that we considered our takeaways in that piece, the first was set internal expectations carefully. We'll hear of a center for innovation. What do they think it's going to be? What are they expecting? What problems are they expecting to bring to it? So how do you make sure your key internal stakeholders understand your strategy, what you're doing, why you're doing it, what KPIs should be assigned to the work, right? So I'm advocating for don't spend a massive amount on it because we intentionally want to tackle issues where we don't yet know what the ROI will be. And thus it would be, we'd be bad stewards of your money if you were pouring too much money into this, because corporations are not research labs. They've got to think they can only invest so much in something until they know kind of how it's going to become operational. And that was really the question we were trying to tackle. The second one was claim your wins. If you are doing partnerships and pilots, on the one hand, you want the groups you're partnering with to get a lot of the credit for these successful pilots. On the other hand, you don't want to then get written out of the story so that everybody inside the company says, oh, that was a really cool gerrymandering project that the investigative journalism team did. And that's not to say, there are going to be colleagues looking to try to write you out of the narrative. It's just you've got to balance that fact that if you do this right, you want your internal partners to shine.
Makes sense.
And yet, you also want, perhaps need, to make sure you, at the very least, keep a log of all the partnerships you've made, connections you've made. I mean, I'll give you a great example. Sometimes our group ended up connecting one part of the company to another part of the company. The company was growing so fast and acquiring so fast, somebody might come and say, I'm working on X, and we'd be the ones to tell them, there's also a team over here that's working on something very similar, and you all don't know one another. And at the very least, you should meet. And so, you know, that's one of the things we thought about a lot, because, you know, when we went to meet with corporate executives about what we had done, a lot of these things that might not have a hard monetary number on the KPI still have a lot of potential value, but you have to track them. You have to keep close records of it so that you can say, we met 18 new teams in the course of the last 6 months, and we have started Y number of pilot projects, and we've connected these groups to resources, and how you're able to translate that into action.
So if I understand correctly, the ROI might not always be so evident monetarily. So, and because of that, one needs to be diligent in maintaining KPIs or some sort of tracking measurement about the other benefits that have occurred because of implementing that approach or the innovation approach. And
absolutely, if you set expectations carefully, you also, back to our point about keeping the budgets lean, you're being a good steward of money and saying, here's what to expect out of a slow innovation project. Because we are trying to think of every pilot project we do as research in and of itself that may have a cool outcome. Here's a pilot project. It comes from a workshop, so it goes out into the world, but we're also learning from its performance. So, you know, you set those expectations carefully, you keep the budget lean, you keep track of what you did and what you learned from it so that you claim your wins. Something that was implicit in that is you have to invest in relationship building, right? You need to become the group that people want to come to with their questions, that when they do a pilot project with you, they're excited about, and they become evangelists for what you're doing to other groups. You know, the ideal version of this would be, and who don't see you as a competitor to them and getting the credit for the projects that take hold. That's where claiming your wins versus relationship building becomes a delicate balance, because you don't want to get yourself written out of the narrative. On the other hand, you don't want to go around and because you helped introduce somebody to somebody, you're now claiming all their work with
all the work,
you know, because you're really a value add to all these groups. You know, none of these pilot projects were pilot projects that the innovation center, my team, did in a vacuum. You know, expressly speaking, we didn't deserve to take credit for any of them, full credit, right? They are collaborative. But I'd say another couple of lessons. One is to think about serendipity. I think about serendipity a lot. A lot of people sort of imagine serendipity as something that happens fortuitously with no, you know, you couldn't have planned it. I mean, it is in effect what it means, right? Oh, this sort of happened naturally. But in order for something serendipitous to happen, you have to do a lot of work, I believe, to foster it and be open to it. You have to be curious. You have to be listening all the time. You have to be looking for those potential points of connection so that when the result happens, it may seem to have not required that much work, to have just naturally happened. That really came together fast. But it's, you know, it's because of a lot of hard work that goes into it. So, you know, one of the reasons why, when some of these groups came to us and said, hey, I really want to do X, do you know of any partner out there that might help? We might be able to say, I know just the group, I'm going to introduce you to X. But that required going to a lot of conferences, doing a lot of reading, being, you know, getting on the radar of places like the foundations that support research in some of those media areas, so that you know the projects that they're funding. And so, you know, that sort of focus on serendipity and connecting colleagues to one another, you know, the idea that, hey, you over here in this team should meet this person who's based in another city working on a different team that you may have naturally never come into contact with. you all should meet up, great things will happen, tell us if we can help, that sort of thing that I think is really worth the investment.
I love this. So I have an analogy because I used to be a performer in an opera company, you know? And the idea is that there was such a flow that everything was happening magically, you know, and in conjunction with the orchestra. But there was a foundation that needed to take place for a performance to look like that. So if I understand correctly, it means putting enough effort to set up those type of conditions so the projects could come serendipitously together, and making sure that we do our best to increase the probabilities of synergies. Would that be a good way to put it?
Absolutely. And then I think this is the most important distinction of all, to be honest, Gonzalo. I think it is, know that if you're at a corporation, especially if you're at a larger company, know that the best slow innovation work will happen outside your walls. That it is one of the reasons why I believe the focus on slow innovation can be best, and that when you focus on slow innovation, a lot of it should go toward partnership, is companies will see problems, and this happens all the time. Companies will see problems that they know are issues that are not their number one most immediate problem.
Okay.
That they also are not the best suited organization to handle. And those become great research questions to partner with academic labs on and consortiums. Okay. Those also become great ways to start to connect with startups who might be already ideally focused on that very question, or when they understand the sort of nagging business questions that companies are facing. And if they could know that, hey, if I launched a business around X and it solved this need, there's companies out there who would, you know, potentially be interested clients in this service, then that becomes a real win-win. And it means the company should invest some in innovation. They should invest in having a function, I believe, focused in any company of, you know, big enough to have an innovation division focused on this. But a lot of that work should then be about partnerships outside your walls with, again, universities, with startups, with foundations that fund interesting research. How can you support it? How can you help build it? Can you give them access to resources that you have? Can you become a case study and allow them to talk about it openly as a public case study for what they do? You know, there are a lot of interesting ways. A lot of our partnerships were not, some of them were Univision investing some money in a university that's doing work around something that it believes in. But a lot of it was, here's a lab doing something really cool, but they need X, and we could provide X in kind, and you build a meaningful partnership through that.
So it would take also the commitment of leadership to be willing to put resources or at least elements out there to go out there to start connecting with the ecosystem. Am I right?
Yep, absolutely. That is a key piece of it. That relationship, I really believe in the strategy we took during the time that we were at Univision. I can't say that it had maximum impact on Univision because of the timetable, because we were operating a long-term strategy in what became a short-term gig. You know, and that's one of the things that I think we have to think about. I've seen this in when companies make major investments in innovation, they end up becoming, and someone confirmed this to me recently, independently, often 2 to 3 year cycles. Here's our new innovation venture. We're going to invest in it. And those that will end up being a focus. But often, by the time 2 to 3 years have gone by, there have been enough factors that have changed in the company that what you'll see is that the elements that could be operationalized out of that innovation investment will have gone. Robin Kwong at the Financial Times gave me this analogy of the lab, the workshop, and the factory floor. So if the lab is those startups or those foundation funding grants or those academic institutions, the workshop or groups like this. You know, the factory floor is the core operations of what the company makes. And so that was really my experience in the last 3 years at Simon & Schuster. We built a new approach to supporting acquisition decision-making, at least new to Simon & Schuster. How can we do more research and embed it into acquisition decision-making at this publisher? And we went through what was originally a five-year plan. We made it 3 years through the five-year plan, and the company decided at that point to take what had been operationalized, move it to the factory floor, and to sunset some of the things that were planned for year four and year five, many of which were data science oriented. But at the same time, what had happened in those 3 years, our parent company had a CEO change, CBS Corporation. Our parent company then was acquired or merged with another company, Viacom, so that they became Viacom CBS.
Yes.
By that time, the parent company who had invested in our five-year innovation venture at Simon & Schuster were no longer in effect our parent company, and Viacom was really the parent company. Then Viacom announced they were selling all of Simon & Schuster.
Wow.
COVID-19 hit.
Talk about
and
a double whammy.
The company went all remote. Our CEO died of Simon & Schuster quite unexpectedly. And we ended 2020 having been sold to Penguin Random House, our largest competitor. And that's now, to this day, held up in review by the Biden administration. So, you know, there is an innovation project that when it was originally signed off on as a five-year plan, made sense. But because of the size of the investment and that involved building new approaches that included data science and sort of software as a service internally, some of those things are pretty large financial investments as the parent company changed and leadership at the local level changed as well inside Simon & Schuster. And then Simon & Schuster was sold. You know, in a way, it's a miracle to have made it 3 years into the five-year plan and to have things that were operationalized. So I've just sort of come to peace with the fact that a lot of these innovation projects, when they are fast innovation, when they are bigger budget and immediate especially, are likely to be on these 2 to 3 year funding cycles. And so with the idea of slow innovation, I'm interested in if the organization is going to be around long enough, which didn't happen with Univision, in that constitution. Univision obviously still around and focused.
Yes.
But it is, how do you carve out a space that you spend half as much for twice as long?
Makes absolute sense. And once you're in the corporate world, then making sure that you let them know that, hey, I want this to cost you less. So we can go with a longer run.
Yeah. Nothing's more interesting than saying, can you give me less than that to a corporate leader who's trying to hand your division a check? And I think that's something to seriously consider. Obviously, the one place I don't believe you should skimp is talent. You want to bring on a few core members who can do this, because you need somebody who can build great relationships, who can divide and conquer. You don't need a lot of micromanagement. Yeah. You want to have a lean team of people who can work across teams, connect people to one another, everyone. You can trust one another and you don't have to double up in all the meetings to all be on all the same calls. So you don't want to run like an agency in that way. Other than having some key senior level or potential high growth talent, then just try to keep budgets as lean as you can until the pilots prove themselves out. It was one of the things at Simon & Schuster, we were doing lower advanced books. So we weren't doing, doing books where we were writing huge six-figure advance payments to an author for a book. A lot of our authors were bought into the idea that this is a test and learn imprint that we had to kind of prove out our model. And it allowed us to try things and be experimental, but not be betting the significant investment from the company on any one idea. then as you see something that's really working, you could put more budget behind that approach.
So would you say that was more mind-settling to a content creator?
Yeah, well, you know, it shaped what types of books that we could do. We started off doing things like baby name books and cookbooks with people who already were recipe developers, and content, you know, partnerships where we published the book of a journalism outlet that would take reporting they'd already done and sort of repackaged it into book form as a way of archiving it, or people who had a big following on Instagram and could turn a lot of the content that they had developed into something that would work in book form. Our goal was, in that case, was really, well, if we're trying test and learn, we can't invest in something where people would need 3 years to quit their job to go do a bunch of historical research to write. You know, fiction would be tougher for our model. So a lot of it was practical nonfiction with
Makes
authors
sense.
Who had side hustle ideas. And they said, look, I'm fine with getting, you know, so many $1,000 up front. And then if the thing really sells, I'll still have an industry standard type of royalty deal. But that just shaped, you know, we kind of set that parameter, or that parameter was set for us early on, but it's one that I liked because it said, if we're trying to find new ways of surfacing ideas, we don't necessarily want to then invest that in things we're not yet sure of. We're trying to figure out our methods. And once we've figured out our methods, maybe we apply them to decisions that you're making about those books, where an author would be looking for this to pay their salary for 2 years for them to go.
Okay.
Write the book versus it being something that they either are adapting something they already have, or they feel that they could do, you know, when they're between these two projects or whatever the case might be. But that was a really fun venture, because every one of our authors were really business partners in a co-venture, you know, where they sign a contract with us, we're giving them an advance so that they have enough resources to cover their costs on what they're doing. And then, if the thing works, both sides get their cut.
A win-win.
Yeah, so it was a little bets type of mentality. Mm. But it meant we had to, you know, if we did not want to become a predatory publisher, we had to think very carefully about who we partnered with and what types of books we'd publish versus what
types
we would.
Makes sense.
Now, in some cases, somebody would come along and they'd already finished a book that was exactly the kind of thing we wanted, and by that point, the fact that we could bring it to market faster, they said, look, I believe in this book, I know it's going to sell, I don't want to take, you know, a year to 2 years to just try to shop this thing around. I want to get this book on out there because it's tied to the work that I'm doing. Whatever their, you know, motivation might be, there were great times that would happen as well. It wouldn't always be we approach the author with the idea. Sometimes we found somebody to say, you know, I've been working on this. Here it is.
Awesome.
Oh, serendipity.
There you go.
That happened with us with a book called Deep Kindness. We were very interested in areas of self-help and thinking about the hard work of being kind, especially with the polarized environment that we were in. Mm-hmm. And we got introduced to this guy named Houston Kraft, who does work in public schools around the country through this organization called Character Strong. And it just so happened, we'd been thinking about these issues. Houston had worked on a book, but he didn't want the book to come out 2 years from now. He really wanted the book to come out and be able to get into schools and have an impact on people, given the issues that were happening in 2020. We were able to sign it up early in the year. He had it mostly, you know, he'd had a good portion of the way finished, work with him on it, you know, getting it together and get it on out to market, and then partner with him to build that book. It was a great example of the sort of thing that we were looking for. But again, serendipity wouldn't have happened if we weren't actively looking for the Houstons of the world.
Makes sense. Last question. Is it possible for small businesses and systems to adopt slow innovation? And I'm speaking as an emerging podcaster, and there might be other small business out there related to the media or other outlets who would be very interested in this slow innovation approach. but they might not have the resources to implement as it's been done according to what you described.
Absolutely. For some organizations that are smaller, you know, there are two ways to think about how slow innovation impacts a startup, a smaller organization. One is, how do you always invest a little bit of your time to thinking about what's next, what's ahead? Two, how can you do that in partnership with other people? You know, can you say, here are resources that I bring to the table. I know X, Y, and Z are some of the issues that I think aren't the big topics of today, but is where the world is headed. Who's doing work on those issues that I might find a productive, in-kind partnership? You know, you may not have a bunch of money to pour into an innovation venture, or even a little bit of money to pour into an innovation venture when you're in startup phase, but you may be able to say, hey, is there a way I could bring my podcast to bear on this? Is there a way that I can, you know, provide some in-kind support to Y in partnership with this lab who's doing Z? And think about that same logic of relationship building and partnership, I think, can make sense. But the other flip side of it is, think about ways that you might be, if you're a startup working on an innovative question, you might be the solution to a larger organization's slow innovation problem. Who are the companies out there that this would matter to? And if they are not going to be able to meaningfully tackle this inside their company, how do you get on their radar? How do you work with them to say, I've been looking at issues like A, B, and C. I really think I can, you know, help you think about that problem in a way that you'd have a hard time doing it yourself, and figure out ways to build meaningful work relationships with larger companies. Because there are downsides to being the small, nimble upstart. You know, you have the vision. You don't necessarily yet have the capital or the cloud of market share that you want. But on the other hand, there's that nimbleness has some abilities, gives you some abilities that larger companies can't pivot, can't do, can't work on. And you can think about how you're the slow innovation solution to somebody else's problem.
I love it. Well, thank you, Sam Ford, for giving us some of your precious time, letting us know about your trajectory and your approach to innovation, meaning slow innovation. This is, I think, pushing or evolving the field of innovation into new areas. And I thank you. And it's been an honor for me to know that I'm talking to someone who is avant-garde in this aspect, Sam.
Well, it was a pleasure. I appreciate your reaching out to me. I'm excited when people are thinking about these questions, and I look forward to staying in touch. If anybody's looking for me, you can find me on Twitter at Sam_Ford, or my website's at samford.wordpress.com. I don't try to be fancy. I don't even have a vanity URL, at least at this point. But if you've got any further questions on anything raised here today, don't hesitate to reach out.
There you have it, folks. This was Sam Ford in Inno Latino. Nos vemos.